Welcome to Not Work, Myth, and Storytelling. This is the show where ancestral wisdom meets the modern imagination. I'm your host and lead storyteller, Marisa Gowdy. I'm a myth worker, a story healer, and a writing coach. I'm the author of The Sovereignty Knot, A Woman's Way to Freedom, Power, Love, and Magic, and the founder of the Writer's Knot and Author's Knot communities. On Knot Work, we explore the mythology and folklore of Ireland and beyond. Whether you're drawn to Celtic culture and the power of the landscape, or whether you just like a good story and expansive conversation, you're in the right place. Fáilte. If you love what you hear and want to support the show, I'd be so grateful if you'd become a paid subscriber to my Myth is Medicine newsletter over on Substack. Look for the link at the top of the show notes or visit mythismedicine.substack.com. Season 6, Episode 19, From Lachlan to Eire, a kayak story from the Outer Hebrides told by Tracy Chipman. Our guest, Tracy Chipman, is a somatic healing artist, an oral storyteller, a creative writer, and a certified TRE provider who weaves together ancient and new experiences designed to invite us into deeper connections with ourselves and the animate world. She resides in Washburn, Wisconsin, on the traditional territories of the Ojibwe peoples. In March 2023, Tracy published her first book, Borealis Mundi, Resting in Place, Loss, and Grace. One quick note before we start exploring the landscapes of the Outer Hebrides, as well as Norway and Ireland. I wanted to invite you to an event that I'll be holding on June 25th at 2 p.m. Eastern. It's for all of my paid Substack subscribers, as well as the longtime members of my Writer's Knot community. In this space, we'll be exploring a set of mythic landscapes, your own inner world. And as we do this, we'll uncover all of the ways in which these different spaces can truly help you shape your own creative voice and vision. To join us, please be sure you're a paid Substack subscriber. Visit me over at mythismedicine.substack.com or just look for the link in the show notes. This online event gives us an opportunity to journey together, to write together, to talk together, and to really set the scene for this next half of the year. I hope you'll consider joining us. And do remember, your Substack subscription is what keeps this podcast on the air. And this event is one way that I love to show my gratitude for all who support this show and also invite you to step a little closer to this work and truly make it your own. And now, on with the episode. All right. So, Tracy, welcome. I'm so excited to have you here on Knot Work Storytelling. And as is our way on the podcast, we ask the story to speak for itself, and then we'll explore together all the ways that it matters and resonates. So I know you want to give us a little introduction to what you'll be offering to us, and then I'd ask you, please, tell us a story.
Thank you for having me. So the story that I'm going to share is quite special, not only to me, but I think special in that it's a story that has likely never been published, and it's a story that was shared orally with me back in 1997 by a tradition bearer named Norman MacLeod from the Isle of Harris in a particular village called Leverborough. And yeah, I would go visiting around the Outer Hebrides as part of my work with a nonprofit called the Hebridean Folklore Project. And many of these recordings over the course of a number of years are available, and that information will be in the notes. So this is a story that was told to me by Norman. So Norman shared the story with me as a story that was told to him by his father when he was just a wee boy. And him and his father would often go out fishing out on the North Atlantic. And off the coast of Harris, there's a particular, I suppose, landform slash seaform that is like a straits. It's a narrows between likely two kind of outcroppings of rock that create this narrow passage. And in Scottish Gaelic, the word for that kind of strait is called coolis, a narrows or a strait. And this is a story this father told him as they would go out fishing on this particular coulis off the coast of the Isle of Harris, off the northwest coast of mainland Scotland. Now, once upon a time, the story goes that way to the north, in a place called Loughlin, and Loughlin is now known as a place we recognize as Norway, there was a king. And as was the way with kings, he thought he was quite a king in every manner. And over the course of his life, he was not regarded as really much of a ruler or a leader. In fact, he seemed to be quite good at burning bridges wherever he went. And the time came to pass that he began to start banishing people who were native to that land for some slight disagreement or a belief that he didn't share. And there was an old woman, and she was known as the Cailleach. Now, in Scottish Gaelic, the word for Cailleach is old woman, but it's also this mythic old woman. And this is how deep we're going in the story today. For she was that kind of Cailleach. And we do not know what she said or what she did or what she didn't do. But this king, this great king of Loughlin, banished her from her homeland. He banished her south and west and south and west. And she left this Cailleach. And she made her way to a land, an island that we now know as Éire, or Ireland. And this island was a much different place than her Loughlin way to the north. And this is where she landed. And this is where she grieved. She grieved the loss of her homeland. She had a way with life, they say. She had a way with plants and animals. And so as she grieved, she began to tend to the life on this new homeland, this new island. And they say that under her mythic touch, that the island life, plants and the animals came to a greater and deeper life. The plants greened until they were bursting with the color of green. And she grew a beautiful garden, seemingly out of a rocky patch of land. And she found that this was a sweeter, more gentle home than she had known in Loughlin. And she came to enjoy and appreciate this southern island. Time passed, as it does, and her fingers were always full of soil, and her eyes were always filled with the sight of beautiful flowers that she had grown. And it was a good life. And at times she would reflect back to her life in Loughlin and feel such fondness and also such sorrow at the reality that she may never return. And more time passed, and perhaps a mountain range formed here and there in the Cailleach. She tended the life on this island. Now, many years later, the Cailleach grown even older and older, the lines on her face deeper, richer, and each line was a story for the telling. And back in Loughlin, that old king, he died. And no one mourned the loss of this ruler. In fact, some say they celebrated. Now, heir to the land was a distant niece. And she had known the ways of her uncle all too well. but what was done was done. And now she would step into this role of sovereign, sovereign as a maiden, untouched, sovereign to herself. And as part of her coming into this role of queen of Lochlin was to repair many of the ruptures done by her uncle. And that would be a lifetime's work, honestly. And she began by pardoning those that her uncle had banished for no reason. Now, there were many that were banished far beyond how she could reach them, but she knew the story of the old Cailleach, the one who had been banished to some southern island far away. For since her departure, the life, the wild life of her own land of Lochlin had diminished without her tending. So the new queen, she called a great swan, known to have the sweetest song. And she bid the swan to travel with a message to the south and the west and further south and further west. And so the swan, as messenger, traveled. It may have taken the swan a year and a day. And eventually the swan arrived and found the Cailleach, her hands deep in the soil, tending her garden in that greening, greening land. And the swan gave the Cailleach the message that her banishment was over and she could leave at will and return to her homeland, to the place of her own origin story forged in the ice mountains of that great place. And the old woman thanked the swan. And as thanks, she said, "Will you allow me to immortalize you in some way?" And the swan consented. And so she raised the swan and she blew her hot, fiery breath onto the swan and threw the swan with all of her might, the great muscles of her gigantic limbs, threw the swan up, up into the sky, where the swan became a constellation there for us all to see. And then the old Cailleach thought and reflected, perhaps for another year and a day, for sometimes it takes time for clarity to arrive, deep in the bone clarity. She had a good life here on this island of Eire. Should she leave? Should she return? And she listened deep, deep, deep inside. And in her bones, she knew that she would need to die at some point and that she would wish to die in Lochlin, in the home of her place. So she decided that she would take some of the rich, fertile soil that had developed over time with her. And she had these great, deep apron pockets. And so she filled her pockets with the soil from her garden. Oh, not all of it, but enough. Her great pockets were bursting with loam and the spores of all number of living things, seeds and lichens and mosses, and all these mycelial roots. And then she dropped to her knees and she blessed that earth, that ground. And ever since, it has indeed been a blessed place. And then she lifted her body from the earth. And she began her journey north, north and east. And through the waves she moved, no boat big enough to carry this mighty Ayah. Her apron pockets full of soil. And as she moved north, north, and east, a gale found her, great wind and great waves. And it was dodgy going for a while. She wasn't sure if she would just be swept away, this great giantess herself. And she stumbled a bit, and some of the soil from her apron pockets spilled out into the sea, scattering in a line that almost follows the coastline of Scotland. And they say that as she scattered the soil from Eire, a new chain of islands was born. This archipelago known as the Outer Hebrides. Mingalay, Barra, Eriske, South Uist, North Uist, Benbecula, Bernere, Harris, Scalpe, and Lewis. And that's it. And when Norman finished his story, oh, his eyes were glowing to have somebody with such a longing to listen to these stories. He was so sweet, and he finished the story with the simple phrase that so many of the people I visited with finished the story. The simple Gaelic phrase, Shenagate, which means, that's it. So, Shenagate.
Oh, you know, there's some sort of sense that that's it has a sense of, and that's all, and it's just something small. But what you gave us was something so tremendous. Mm-hmm. Tracy, thank you for the gift of this story. And thank you to the spirit of Norman who lives on and through this. My eyes just kept filling with tears through so much of your telling, especially the incantation of the place names at the end. There's something that just gets to the cellular memory there somehow that really, it speaks to the bones, right? Our bones of being of the earth itself, of the stones. Oh, I'm so excited to explore so much of this with you. I think when you and I first got to meet, I mentioned to you that we joke on this show that on Not Work, every season is Kalyak season. So I really rather love that here we are in the midst of June in Gemini season in so many ways of the strawberries and the first summer flowers, that you really give us this gift of the perennial and timeless nature of the Kalyak herself and the sense that this is a creation story that is outside of time and is all of time. So thank you for welcoming us into an expanse so great, even from, and I'm going to ask you to say the name once again of that little bit of strait between two rocks. What's the name? It's such a narrow space that expands us to so much. What's that word?
Well, it's known as Kuliskara, because of course the old Kayak herself was known as the Kayak Skara. And I've looked and asked around any translation for that word skara, but I haven't found it. I'm sure there was or is some, but known to somebody. So the coolest or the narrows, coolest skara, the kayaks straight, the kayaks narrows.
I rather love the sense of language lost and yet language found and the hope for finding it again. And also the melancholy that comes with knowing that any story we have from this part of the world or from any of the ancestors is just the tip of the tip of the tip of that iceberg, right?
Indeed, indeed. And that was often something that I would encounter as I traveled around these islands, you know, from Barra all the way up to Scalpe and Harris. You know, I would get a tip from so-and-so and so-and-so, I'll go and talk to, you know, old Morag. She might have stories. So I'd reach out to Morag and she might say, well, no, I don't have any stories. My granny had stories. And I might say, well, you might know the stories as you knew from your grandmother. And that's something, like that's worthy and important.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's it, right? Like the pieces and the reinvention and the re-enlivening through the telling. Mm-hmm. And that's just the nature of oral tradition in so many regards.
Yeah. And I've heard that so often from folks who have collected either songs or story, is that so often speaking to the elders, whether it's a sense of humility or whether it is also an embodiment of saying, well, the tradition has diminished in the sense that there are more distractions and all these different reasons why stories erode and get lost. It's a common refrain I've heard of folks saying, oh, well, if only you could have heard from old Joe Mack or whatever it may be. And yet, of course, the gold remains. And here it is for us today. So I just, again, want to thank you for the gift. I'm sort of in that sense of the gratitude of at the abundance of what you've given us is something that makes me the best kind of speechless, which of course is challenging in a podcast, but we're going to find our way through.
Right. And I really think that this all goes to the tradition bearers that I sat with, like all gratitude for recognizing that this was a safe place for them to share. Norman gave his permission for me to share this story, and any of the stories that I might tell, they have been, you know, permission has been given to share. And I think that's an important piece. They were very pleased to have the stories live, and wherever they might land, it was a gift. And it's always so important to just honor them. And I'd like to just, in that vein, I'd love to share just a wee bit about Norman. So he grew up in Leverborough, which is a village on the Isle of Harris. And one of his claims to fame, and if you would go to Leverborough to this day and actually ask the right person about Norman, and he was quite well known in the area for being like telling some of the stories, but also he built a concrete boat that actually was seaworthy. So don't know how that happened or whatever, but he built a boat out of concrete that actually sailed on the North Atlantic. And that still rings in people's memories about Norman.
Yeah. Oh, wow. And I love, you know, you and I both share having spent time in Ireland and Scotland in the 90s when, you know, of course it was a different time. It was a couple of three decades ago at this point, but there was, and I think maybe you and I might share this too, is that sense of going over there as wide-eyed, eager Americans. At least my experience in Ireland was very few of my peers who were necessarily all that interested in Irish culture, Irish mythology, Irish archaeology. Certainly there were some, but it's very different now with the kind of explosion of, you know, reclaiming indigeneity and understanding colonization, all these different ideas hadn't emerged yet in quite the same way. So that sense of, I would love for you to talk a little bit more about your experience of going over there then and what drew you there and what that might have been like, and, you know, sitting and sharing what I'm sure was endless cups of tea.
Endless cups of the strongest tea and always like a bit of home baking. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And mm-hmm. It was just so generous to receive those gifts. You know, I have always known a deep love of, as a child, it occurred to me as like Britain, the British Isles, mm-hmm. and I didn't have like the discernment or the knowledge to discern that there were other names and other islands, right? It occurred that way. And there's some ancestry tied in there. And then when I was old enough to make decisions, and this was after I had graduated from college, and I went traveling overseas with a girlfriend one summer, and that kind of opened my Midwestern eyes to how other peoples live. And that just really became a deep impulse to do that more. And so I sold most of my belongings and I got a one-way ticket to London back when you could get one-way tickets to London. And I traveled and I arrived in Scotland just thinking I'd be there for 30 days. And I ended up there for 6 months and just hiked and traveled and connected with folks and went to some of the Inner Hebridean Islands. And that love of Scotland and place, and was also over in Ireland for a bit. By the time it was time to go back to the US, back to America, I knew that it would be a place that I'd always return to. And I just didn't know how that would look. And then in my 30th year, there was this impulse to return. And I went to both Ireland and to Scotland with the intention of really finding something meaningful that was just more than just being the average visitor. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I had a dear friend in Edinburgh and he invited me up to the island of South Uist. He's an ornithologist and was doing some birdie research up there. And he invited me up and I started asking questions about stories. And folks said, well, if you're interested in the stories, then you need to come back and do something because they're dying. And some of the universities at the time who had already done a lot of field work weren't allowing, say, the grandson of the grandfather who had given stories. They weren't allowing access. So it was kind of a breach between some of the academic institutions mm-hmm. and just the folks from the islands. And this was a big point that came up repeatedly. And they said, come and do something. And I guess I was young enough and naive enough, even though I was 30. So I founded a nonprofit. And just through the connections I had over there, I was living in the Pacific Northwest, where there is more of a kind of a consciousness around Celticity, right? That and a lot of expats still in the area. Mm-hmm. And yeah, this very grassroots movement brought me back to South Uist to begin field work in 1996. And, you know, I found connections. I hitchhiked all through the islands. That's how I got around, or walked a long ways in horizontal rain, and eventually arriving at the hearth of someone who gave me tea and often mm-hmm. stories.
Mm. Wow.
So that's the short story.
Yes. Thank you for doing this work. Thank you for following the passion, the risks that you took, and they were real. There was lots of other choices that could have been made, and you followed the voice and the story that said, there's something here.
Yeah. Mm. Absolutely. And that is what I did. And it was kind of a mad thing to do, but I have no regrets. It's one of the greatest gifts of my life to be able to have been there, to walked and heard, you know, without, like, just to walk for miles. Mm-hmm. There's a deep connection with the land that these languages, you know, Irish and Scottish Gaelic, are so mm-hmm. deeply connected to the physical landscape. Mm-hmm. And that's something that as English speakers and in our modernity, driving and, you know, flying, we miss out on the deep immersion of many indigenous languages, perhaps all that have to just a landscape.
Yeah.
And I was privy to that in my own little tiny way, which was just so beautiful. It's such a gift.
That gift of orality that we can feel as if we can sort of lean, you know, through some little passage of time, but it's that sense of being fully enraptured in it. I'm not sure if you know Sophie Strand's work. She just wrote at length just today, actually. I'll include the story in the show notes because it feels very apropos to really be speaking about the power of what's truly happening with oral cultures and the way that they share stories, and that there's transmission that comes through with that. Absolutely. And certainly in this story, you are offering us so many transmissions.
Yeah. And I speak at a little bit more, I share more about this. I a couple of years ago, I published a book, my first book. It's a book that features four different locations around the world because it's so based and placed. And one of those is in Scotland. And it really speaks to how language is deeply connected to the landscape and how engaging with Gaelic speakers and hearing their stories was so impactful and meaningful. And then my own journey walking on the land. So, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, well, let's kind of take this conversation. I'm so glad we have this sort of foundation of it. Let's take the conversation back to the story, the story that got us in here together. And I'm curious, I'll start here. And especially as you're naming the way in which, you know, you really walking with the stories, with the language, with the sense of place. Did you have a feeling when you were in your story collection days, did beings like the Kalyak walk with you? Did you really have a sense of them on the land? Was that not necessarily part of your consciousness in that way?
I would say that it was more about something more elemental and unnamed.
Mm, yeah.
Yeah. So it may not have been that mythic role or that I had language for, even though I knew what Kayakh was, and it could be the lady next door, and it could be this mythic energy. It was more this deep elemental experience of the land and knowing that wherever your eye might land as you look, like 360 degrees, because there are very few trees in the Outer Hebrides. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So there's significance, like that mound there may be regarded as a Sheben, a fairy knoll, and that the language itself like had these elemental communicative qualities. Mm-hmm. So I hope that speaks to your question.
It does. And I just appreciate that power to say that what reached you as you name it, as elemental, like to go to being in story and also to reckon with the more than human world in an unstoried way, I think is so valuable because in our, we human creatures love to categorize and to name, we think of it as part of our birthright. So I love that you sort of tipped that expectation, said even as a story collector, you were meeting the world around you without imposing story upon it. So I'm really grateful for that.
Yeah, it's very powerful. And those experiences were both in Scotland, particularly in the West and in the islands, and then in the West of Ireland as well. Really quite profound, elemental kind of conversings that didn't land with any meaning making or even context. Yeah, very powerful.
Right. Which really speaks to the ways in which, you know, knowing that the sense of culture that is so distinct to these individual islands, these individual countries, you know, you really, as you weave together the land of Norway and Scotland and Ireland all in this one tale, that you're also emphasizing the continuity of these spaces and these distinct personalities, but also the ways in which the earth has no idea what we're naming her. She frankly doesn't care. I think there's certain words and languages she probably feel like a good, you know, back rub to her. But generally speaking, as much as it's so important for us to retain the unique flavor of individual human culture, there's also that power in recognizing that, I guess to go back to that word, unstoried nature of these different spaces and what they share, again, at that elemental level, as you named.
Beautiful, beautiful. And there's a language there, but it's not a language that we might even, you know, it's non-human. It's a more than human language.
Yeah.
I think that there's a listening and a relating to that language that has been lost and forgotten in the realm of modernity and the loss of what is oral and has a fluidity and soaked in the imaginal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I'm hearing the sound of swan's wings over the Corrib River in Galway, right? And knowing that those swan wings would sound exactly the same no matter what, you know, island you're in what country. And that the universality of it is so deeply comforting. So I want to, let's to bring us to that story that, oh, the image of Kayakh throwing the swan into the heavens is such a powerful one. And that's just one of many. But I'd love to take the story to your experience as storyteller. When you think about this story, I just presume maybe you think of Norman and him offering it to you. But is there an image in this story that is most potent and powerful for you?
I think the most powerful image for me, and as it really comes through as I really reflect back onto Norman's telling, was in his telling, he never really kind of contexted it in that she was this mythic creature or mythic being. You weren't sure, but until then, there she is walking through the water, walking through the ocean, that you got the scale of who she was. And so that image of her pockets just full of this rich soil that she was in part co-creator of, and moving through the North Atlantic in this kind of initiation way, moving up the coast and having this origin story of these islands that, so that piece. And then on the other hand, it's just the sweetness of imagining Norman in a boat with his father on the Kuliskara, and his father telling the story there as they're just on the Minch, where they're just in the water And that also is just so poignant and sweet and beautiful.
Yes. Oh, that struck me so much as well. Yes. This is the story within a story is so potent. And thank you for highlighting that real transformation where Kalyak really goes from subject of this unjust king into her own supernatural sovereign self. And that wisdom is held within the story in such a subtle way that it doesn't call attention to itself, but it feels so fundamentally part of the movement of what's being expressed in the tale. You know, it's that marvel, right? We sit with story and we're constantly amazed by what it does, right? We know how much modern storytellers and novelists are trying to always find new ways to have plot twists and this and that. It's like, we can't, it's all here. We have the original archetypes already. The transformation's already baked in.
That's right. That's right. And Norman didn't need to give any backstory. He didn't need to, if you will, massage the audience's listening. It was all inherent in there, and it would come through really when the listener was ready to like hear what often wasn't said, if that makes sense.
Yes, yeah. Yes, yes. Because I love the way you offer us the sovereign maiden, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm sure for depending on the listener and what kind of room it is at any given time, she could shine off the unwritten pages of the story or just be, you know, kind of melted into a big story about the Kalyak. But I love that she has her presence here too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Indeed.
Yeah.
I recently shared on my podcast, which you'll be joining me at some point in the months to come. I shared a poem by a local poet who speaks to the word virgin and how some of the etymology of that word is deeply couched in the meaning of sovereign unto herself, that purity equates itself with sovereignty,
right?
More, you know, in a way that it's kind of lost to our kind of modern ears and what that word now connotes, you know?
Yes, yes. To behold to oneself, right? Yeah. Without having to be coupled, one could still be a full individual.
That's right.
Remarkable thing for all of us at every time.
Indeed, indeed, indeed.
There's a couple of phrases, and I know that for an oral storyteller, some phrases may emerge in a story again and again, and some may come off in a surprise, but there's a couple of phrases that I couldn't help but write down because they just captured my attention so much. And it was really when you were describing when Kalyak went to Eira and when she was sort of doing her work and what she was doing, what she does, which is she had a way with life. And I just loved that phrase and that sense of, goodness, wouldn't that be one of the greatest things to ever have said about you? You know, especially if you're someone who, you know, has a green thumb or, you know, to have a way with life would be such a gift. And under her mythic touch, the plants and animals came to a deeper life. And I think those are words that are going to hold me, like maybe, I don't know if it'd be a cement boat or it'll be a little skin cura. Those words will hold me for a long time. There's something, there's a real gift in those.
Beautiful. And I think, I don't know, those words certainly aren't part of what may usually come through. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's been a while since I've told the story. And I also think that you just honoring the container that you've created for a deeper listening and sensitivity to some of the more nuanced aspects of being human in a more than human world, and how the stories are often blueprints that seems too linear of a word, but they often hold that tension between the human and the more than human in a very particular way. And so you've helped create that. So this life, this mythic life, this life of what she brought to the island in her visit, it's really connecting in with your listeners that I haven't met and spoken and shared with before. Do you know what I mean? Like they're present now between us, thanks to your container holding.
Yeah. Well, that's gorgeous. And that really makes me wonder a little bit about you as storyteller and what your experiences are in holding a room holding a circle with a story. And maybe you could just talk with us a little bit about what that's like in various environments, in various ways, like what your experiences have been like.
Well, I mean, it speaks to what I just tried to share a little bit about the co-creative nature mm-hmm. of storytelling. So
right.
it's not just me telling a story, and that there's active listening involved and imagining involved, and that even can transcend like the past, the present, the future, right? Like mm-hmm. we want to go down that rabbit hole right now. So like I show up for a storytelling, and whether it's more like performance-based or whether it's something more circular, I don't want to say casual, but a willingness to go kind of a deeper dive mm-hmm. into some of the underbelly of the story. And every telling is different, and not only because of what may be spoken, literally spoken, but how it's received and who's there. So you get a sense as a teller. For me, I get a sense of, it's kind of like reading the room, but it's all incredibly subtle cues. Mm-hmm. And it's often completely nonverbal as to how it occurs or why I'm doing or saying what I'm saying. But then it's inevitable that someone after will say, God, when you said that bit, it just really, like, something about that struck me.
Mm.
So whether I'm telling with a group of kiddos, which I'll be doing quite a bit of this summer for various summer reading programs, or a group of women who are, you know, steeped in the mythopoetics of story.
Mm-hmm.
And really looking to engage with story as ally for their own mythic lives, for their own soul transformations. It really speaks to the vastness of what's possible mm-hmm. just through the simple art and craft and co-creative experience of storytelling.
Yeah. What that calls to mind for me is there's a quote attributed to Finn McCool, that where a bunch of the Fianna warriors were sitting around and they were saying, what is the sweetest sound in the world? Right.
Yes.
And what was the sweetest sound in the world? Do you remember the line?
The music of what is.
Yes. Yes. Mm. And I feel like you just captured that so beautifully. Because when I entered into this project, gosh, 3.5 years ago, when I started producing, and I got the nudge from an Irish goddess who told me to do this over my autumn equinox fire. I very rarely get such clear instruction. Thank goodness she was very clear with me. But I look back and it's the sense of, wow, Natasha Dabla is, you know, she is bold, right? And that sense of to take on storytelling, which is not an art I have trained in. I come to this with a literary background. I come for this as someone who loves story, but is learning more and more as I get to sit with storytellers like yourself, that just this honor and reverence for the craft that I have not studied formally. And every time I get to sit with a storyteller like yourself who just inhabits the tale so fully and has clearly been in a beautiful apprenticeship of all the different themes and images and the culture. And it ends up one of those situations where the whole is greater than the sum of the parts, right? And so just my ongoing reverence for that, and just grateful that I was a bold girl all 4 years ago to come up with the idea, but saying, oh, I didn't know what I didn't know. And I'm grateful that I get to learn it now. And I think those are the best projects we ever take on, right? We say, oh, this is bigger than I thought. I wouldn't have ever taken this on if I had known. Thank goodness I did.
That's right. That's right. And that speaks to almost that innocence in you of not knowing and being willing to not know and still engage in this mm-hmm. kind of trusting way of innocence, moving into that.
Right. Which I think is important in a lot of cultural work that we do, where it's that sense of, you know, because of course we do, and I, you know, I totally recognizing and grateful for the ways in which you make it very clear these stories were gifted to you. You were asked to hold them and to share them, and being aware that you're not, you know, plucking them from the land and appropriating them. And there's also that sense of needing to walk into certain rooms unaware of the power of the questions we're asking, not because we're going in like thieves to say, I'm going to take this from you, but to say, I'm going to learn this from the ground up, and I don't even know where the ground is. That's right. And there might be an accidental castle built in the air, but reality will strike and draw me back down again, because you tell enough Kalyak stories. You know, you've got a giantess who's made of the earth herself. She'll help keep finding ways to get you grounded in.
That's right. That's right. And then again, and then that reconnection to grounding by walking on the land, being on the land. Yeah. With your head full of stories, with salt in your ears and your nose, just that viscerality and the elementalness, not only about those unseen elementals, but the ones that are just right there with you, you know, with, not on the screen, right? Not through an earbud.
Yeah.
Experienced. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that willingness and somehow finding the way to revisit and revisit and to dwell. Overall in Ireland, I spent a couple of years there. And over my time, I've managed to get to Inishmore on the Aran Islands 13 times. And I just needed to go to the same. I needed to go to Dun Dúchathair, to the Black Fort every time. I'm going in July and I won't make it down. And it's that sense of like, okay, at 13, she says, it's okay, you should go to Donegal because you'll never get there if you also try to do Galway. But just to say that sense of, can we have the bravery to, rather than see everything on the itinerary, or rather than say, you know, I'm going to die having seen 50 countries. Mm-hmm. It's that sense of knowing I have known a couple of places well, and I've dared to introduce myself. And perhaps there's a stone that will recognize me the next time I come back.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. That revisitation. It's intimacy, really, isn't it? It's creating intimacy with place. And even in the retelling of stories over and over and over, it's never like, oh, I've been there, done that, right?
Right.
With the story, it's the telling, the retelling of it, and the revisitation of a place. We're developing this intimate relationship.
Yeah.
And that, my dear, is what it's all about.
Right. Yes. Well, in this vein, I want to ask you a question that I am constantly dancing with and sometimes struggling with, that I feel is important to ask all of my guests from North America, those of us who are holding stories from 3, 4, 5,000 miles away, perhaps that many thousand years ago, what it's like for you to be anchoring in these Scottish Celtic tales into the land upon which you live now, and what your experience is with that as a storyteller across cultures and across miles. I'd love to hear your thoughts about how that lands for you in your body, how you carry that in your heart and in your practice.
Mm-hmm. And I might ask you to reshare the question as I track and respond to what's rising up. Like, I think the most constant piece throughout my 30-year journey, considering myself as someone who stepped on the path of oral storyteller, is the heart. Yeah. The heart, trusting the heart. And as I tell stories here on Turtle Island, on North American soil, encountering often mostly folks of Northern European descent, not always, but most often. And one, there's such a desire for them to hear stories of their potential homeland, or just that they have a connection with. And it might be that kind of castle in the air, that romantic quality that likely drew me to like pursue and like follow the thread of charm. I think, I don't know if this is relevant to the question, but I think there's, as I've grown older and as I've moved on this path for decades, there's really a humbling and like a deeper sense of deeper, I want to say, vulnerability around sharing the stories. And I think in the 90s, when I did this work, the work of collecting the stories with the Hebridean Folklore Project, it was just such an act of heart. And as the world moved on and as sensitivities came around appropriation, you know, that came into the conversation. And I have like had people come up being angry with me afterwards And that was hard on my heart and had me do some deep reflection. Mm-hmm. And I always came through that with, like, I was in integrity mm-hmm. with myself, with the land, and with the people that I spent time with, particularly in the Outer Hebrides. And I think it, and kind of growing my own muscle mm-hmm. of, it hurts to be called out in that particular way sometimes, and then being able to be an advocate for the messy middle of, like, there are some of us who can share. And yes, I have permission, and that's a super important piece. And there's also just that messy part of it we spoke a little bit about, which I don't have any answers for, but I think mm-hmm. that is part of the dialogue more now, right? Like here in 2025 than it was even in 2000.
Right. Well, I just want to tell you how grateful I am to receive that answer and how much it does resonate. And just the naming of, it's messy sometimes, and it is a constant sense of balancing and rebalancing. And there are difficult encounters over anything that could be called cultural work, right? And you encounter any number that people may or may not be in right relationship themselves when asking those questions, because if everything's up for people in terms of saying, is this okay? Is this okay? Is this okay? It's bound to, again, use that word messy, but it is not necessarily true that the person who is challenging you are themselves standing in right relationship with story and with earth. They may just be wondering, am I doing this? And there's projection contained in. And sometimes we have to check ourselves and say, oh, wait, am I, you know, in some ways profiting off other tales, ought this story be told by, you know, from another set of lips? And so without wanting to assume any of that is your story, I would say that's what I'm hearing from you. And these are the questions that this allows us to be with and dance in. And something that strikes me too is, you know, you have, as part of your work in terms of sitting in circle and sitting and doing performance, that being with the people in the room and, like, making the music and the music at the, you know, being the music of what happens is itself such a powerful gift, that we are meant to offer these stories in rooms. And if you have that gift, one ought not squander it, right? And it becomes a slightly different thing, I think, when we're doing it digitally and it's going, you know, am I the one to write this if it's going to go up on Substack? Maybe a different set of questions to ask than saying, you know, when you're going and embodying these stories in a room, I couldn't see there's anything other than a straight up gift. So thank you for adding nuance to the conversation that I'm always having with myself, and that all of my guests don't necessarily know I'm also having with them, because I'm always, I think we all get to ask it, you know, because these are stories about heritage and lineage and ancestry and identity. And they're also a damn fine tale about an unjust king and, you know, a Kalyak who went across the waters to live out another more fertile life for a while.
Indeed. Beautiful. Thank you for asking this question, and keep asking, because I think the answer is continually changing, just like everything. And what is that in itself is an inherent of heart and inquiry and integrity in my world. So
yeah. Thank you. Yes, you're welcome. So as we start to kind of call our circle round and bring us back to the beginning, back to the story, but back to, you know, the roots of everything you've offered to us today, are there any final thoughts you want to circle back to?
I think the piece, kind of thinking back to that woman I was who stepped onto the island, who arrived by ferry from Oban to Loch Boisdale in South Uist, and not knowing what the next 3 months would hold. Mm-hmm. And the ideas that I had in my head about stories from the Outer Hebrides or Scottish stories and how they sat within the realm, the cosmology of Celtic stories. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it wasn't necessarily based in reality. Mm-hmm. And as I walked the land and visited often elder by elder, coming to earth, coming to ground with the reality and the lived tradition which lived really outside of what my American brain had thought it would be like. Mm-hmm. And even the stories themselves, which may not have had any big flash American endings. Of course they didn't.
Right.
Their endings were often literally as simple as Shenagate. Mm-hmm. That's it. Mm-hmm. That's it. And then the deep appreciation, how sweet that became over time as I moved through my own response to, oh, but where are the big stories with the big endings? To like the simplicity. Yeah. This is where this story comes to an end.
Shenagate. Oh, well, Tracy, thank you. Goramila Mayaget, thank you for sharing your story with us today. Mm-hmm. Can you perhaps give our listeners a little bit of a hint about where to find you and follow your work so they can continue to spin with you in your tales?
Yeah. So, you know, I think the most exciting piece that I'm working on right now is over on Substack at my podcast, Sometimes Written Cast, called A Year in a Day. Mm-hmm. And earlier in the spring, we entered into the second cycle. It's a 13-month cycle in keeping with that whole like notion of a year and a day, which would be 13 months in months mm-hmm. time. And the second cycle is all about exploring the seasons of women's lives mm-hmm. from the sovereign maiden, moving into the fertile aspect of mother and all that that holds, biological motherhood and non-biological motherhood. And then we'll move into the mad or matriarch or sometimes maga form of, you know, that autumn of our lives. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, moving into the holy ground of kayach, of crone, that we'll get to towards the winter months. And the beginning of the month around the full moon is a story, one from my repertoire that pertains and connects with some aspect of those seasons of women's lives. And then towards the new moon of every month is this really deep emergent collaboration with folks like yourself and other amazing women who have just agreed to come and collaborate through this emergent conversation relating to the phase of life that they're in or relating to the story that was shared early in the month. And so there's all kinds of ways that it can go. It's pretty nonlinear. And then there's also my website, which is tracychipman.net, with lots of offerings. And there's even a story library. So you can just click on some stories and have a listen. Yeah, those are probably the main two places. And you can find me on Instagram at all here dwell free with periods between each of the words.
Perfect. I'll be sure to link that so people can find you easily Well, I'm so grateful that we've got this chance to begin our journey together here. So thank you so much for the beautiful wealth of this story. It's going to be with me for a long time.
Morantang Mograi. Hashin Ma. Hashin Ma.
Mila Buikis. Thank you, Tracy.
Yeah. Cheery.
Thank you for tuning in to Not Work Myth and Storytelling. Please subscribe and review the show on your favorite podcast platform, and do share this episode with other lovers of mythology and story. By the way, everyone is a lover of mythology and story, even if they've forgotten. Creating this show is a labor of love, and your support will help me continue to craft and share stories throughout this season and beyond. Please consider becoming a paid subscriber to my newsletter, Myth is Medicine, over on Substack, where you'll find new writing and conversations each week. You can find out more about my writing, my book, our online writing communities, as well as how to work with me as a writing coach at marisagowdy.com. Gratefully, I live, write, work, and record this podcast on the ancestral lands of the Munsee Lenape tribe, whose name means original people. Music on this show is performed by Beth Sweeney and Billy Hardy.